recording now. So, for those that took the test on yesterday, you're probably still having hand cramps from the exam, right? I imagine. Whoever was in those classes, right? I'm joking. I see expressions over there. It's not so bad. It's pretty good. But it was hard. You got to study, right? Keep studying. And we didn't get all through cardio, but I had to change some of the tests because we didn't cover some of the stuff I thought I was going to get to, so we have some changes that we were crossing up. But remember, we stopped the exam content from Thursday last week, right? Okay, so what are we going to do today? We are going to finish cardiovascular, and then we might get into respiratory. We'll see where we go from there. But it was brought up too about where all the points are coming from, like what we have in lecture. Remember, we have something like this. Where's that little thing? Oh, yeah, here we go. So, exam one was 80 points, right, to give you all a buffer. Exam two, this exam's 100 points. But then we have the final, which is 150, because it's cumulative. I just want to remind you, in case you want to start studying the old stuff again. And then lecture, assignments, and quizzes was 80 points. So where did those 80 points come from? So how many quizzes have we had so far? How many assignment things? Let's see. We've had... Is this the first quiz we had on sensory? Yes. But there was one before that. Where'd that one come? Oh, there it is. So one, two, right? Two. That's 20 points. I think that was 20 points.
I think one of them was worth five.
Was one worth five?
Yeah.
Oh, goodness. Okay. So we have some more. Okay, let's add this up.
We have 3 10-point quizzes and 1 5-point quiz.
3 quizzes? 3 10-point quizzes?
3 10-point quizzes and 1 5-point quiz.
3 10-points and 1 5-points, which then equals 35 points, right? And then we had a lecture assignment. Okay, lecture assignment. And that was 10 points. So that's 45, right? Yes? Is that where we are? Okay. Oh, we had 2 lecture assignments? What was that one?
There were 2 assignments that were 1 point.
Oh, about the membranes?
And evolutionary physiology. Yeah.
What did we do about that one?
There were 8 appointments.
Did we put it on here?
What was interesting in the evolutionary physiology paper to you? And then there was also membranes, differences in lipid composition.
Oh, yeah.
Cell membrane.
That whole thing was 10 points.
Both 1 point, so we're at 47 points total.
Oh, that was like 2 points?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay. Okay. Stressed you all out ahead of time. So that's 47 points, right? Total? Okay. All right. Now where are we? We are down here somewhere. Okay. So maybe if we watch Muscle Man on the EMG thing, that'll give you some extra points. All right, so where are we? We are somewhere here. 4, 4, 4, 4. Yeah, we're in this testing period thing. So there's no lecture next Tuesday, but I'm going to record something on Echo 360, which I know that you guys will miss class, but the others won't. So what we'll probably do is to put something on a quiz related to the Echo 360, okay? That forces you to kind of watch it because I know you'll be deprived of not having lecture. So that way you'll have something to watch. So I'll make some kind of short quiz, maybe an online quiz or something. If I can figure out how to do that in Canvas, that'll be great just to make sure that you watch it and go through it. Okay, so I'll try to do something for that on, where is that day? I guess that's coming up. Today's the 2nd. 4th is Thursday. So we'll do something in here, some kind of quiz thing. That'll give us an extra 10 points. So now we're up to 57. We've got to go to 80 somehow. So I can't give quizzes during dead week. I found out people didn't like that last year. So I'll have to do some. And then here's 2 more quizzes. So that's 20 more points. So let's add 20 to that. That'll be 77. Oh, my gosh. We're almost there. Okay. So then we'll have 3 more points. So I'll make a quiz on the Echo recording. Okay. Maybe online. Boost grades. Right?
Will it be due the same day?
No. We'll make that later. We'll kind of keep it open for a while. Might want to get together with buddies and figure out the answers or something. We'll find out something interesting for you. Maybe listen to EKG sounds or something. And then we have 3 points that we have to make up somewhere. So we'll do something with those 3 points, okay? Okay, sound good? So there'll be one more quiz, maybe something you can work together, but it's mostly to get you to make sure you cover the material, because really the main thing is that you learn the material. I don't really worry about it. If everybody made an A, that would be great. Okay. Okay, so we'll do something like that, and then there'll be 3 points somehow. I'll create 3 points in here, maybe some of these little blood gas analysis on respiratory acidosis or alkalosis or something like that. There's some really cool online little quizzes that we can do. Okay, does that make sense? All right, so one more. Something fun to do. I'll make that up. I'll put an echo up. I will record. Probably fall asleep doing that, but I'll do it. Okay. And we are somewhere here. Where did we finish? Oh, yes. We were on the EKG stuff. Okay. Okay, good. And if you got the test this afternoon, it's okay. Drink lots of coffee. You know, get yourself worked up. And then the others have it on Wednesday. That's the real hard sections. You know, extra hard test on Wednesdays. I'm joking. They're all not so bad. And then, of course, in case you're worried about grades being different in one section or the other, I will look at the distributions of each section and see what's happening. Okay? So, any questions generally? First off, anything? Stressing out? No? We're good. And so we're going to continue on with the EKG trace. These are really quite amazing. I know you had the lab, and it might have, you've already passed that, and you might have like forgotten some of that stuff. But it's really quite neat. You don't have to memorize all the time periods in here, but we should know generally what these periods represent, right? So let's just go through that. What is this P wave? Anybody? Atrial depolarization, and then it goes through the which node? SA, AV, QRS is ventricular depolarization, and then this is the repolarization we talked about. And you can imagine you could measure the rate from here to here, right, over time. These strip chart recorders, the old-fashioned strip chart recorders, had a certain amount of time base on it, 0.04 seconds. And you could actually measure the amplitudes with these scales that they had on. So it was all calibrated. You see those in the old movies, right, going across the little strip chart recorder or on the screen. And you can measure your rate by looking at this interval. And did you do this in lab, right? Did you do it on yourselves or your partner, right? Did you have to do it by hand, or was it automatic in your software that you were doing? By hand. You could have put a threshold across there and count just, you know, it would then average it out for you. But it's a good value. Okay, so we'll go through that. But the EKG is so amazing because you can do so much with it. Let's flip this thing over to see if I can make this thing work. Okay. So you can take different leads. Let's see if this thing will work. So you know there's a 3-lead, right? Like one, let's see, two, no, yeah, one goes across here, 2 and 3 leads, right? And so those leads, in the old days, they used to like put it on your wrist, right? But now they kind of put it on your chest, right? Then there's the 12 leads, right, that go across your chest and around the side. And what do those leads do? What do? They measure the electrical field of the heart beating, right? And why do we have an electrical field? Just to kind of refresh our memory. What are we picking up? So not so much neuronal firings, but how do we pick up a change in the voltage? Like on the EEG or an EMG? You're on the right track, kind of. Extracellular recordings on a nerve, what were we picking up? The action potential, right? But what makes it that electrical event? It has to move in ions, right? Ion movement, charged ions moving from one location to another. So what we're actually measuring are those charged ions moving into the cells, like your muscle cells, right? Or your EMG, if it was a EMG recording, An EEG, it's the electrical events that are occurring due to the ion movements. So we're measuring the ion movements as the atria depolarize or the ventricles depolarize or repolarize. Okay? So if you're measuring these leads across the front of you, you're measuring the electrical axes in this plane, right, in front of you, right? If you measure the 12 EKG lead, it goes around your side, and then you can measure the electrical axis in a different plane. So the 12 lead EKG is much more informative of more of a three dimensions of your heart. But you can use the front, the three leads, and it's really quite interesting because you can tell so much with it. I forgot what I told you last week, actually. But if you look at these, let's see if this will draw. Okay, so that's lead one. Let's see, I think I wrote it down here somewhere. Let's see if I got it straight. Lead one. This lead one. This is lead two. They use these Roman numerals. This is lead three. And where are the negative signs on this thing? The negative signs. Lead three negative up here. Lead two negative over here. Lead one negative over here. Okay, so this is what they call, if you put your body on top of this, my drawings are horrible. So here's an arm. Here's the chest cavity. Here's an arm. The chest cavity. All right, this is like SpongeBob. All right. So you can look at these EKGs, leads, right? One, two, and three. But you can put those all together, and you can have lead. Is this working? Then you can have lead one, lead three, lead two. Okay, so we'll do this again. You just move these over. Lead one, and that's negative over there. Lead, this is three. That's negative. And lead two over here, and it's negative up here. Okay? And then what's the angle for these? If we divided it up, you know, 180 by three. 60, right? Okay, so 60 degrees. Okay, so 60, 60, 60, right? Okay, so what's really interesting is you can look at these leads that are recording, like lead one and lead three across your body, and let's draw something here. Let's do lead, is this going to show up? Let's do lead one, and let's look at just the QR, it's just the QRS complex. So let's say we have this down here, we have the Q, and then we have the R, and then we have an S, QRS, okay? Let's say this is, you know, divided up on a grid paper, okay? One, two, and three, okay. I know I messed this up a little. One, two, and three, okay? And this is one and, you know, one down here. So what you do is you subtract out the ones that go below the trace. So this is one and one. So that's minus two, and we have plus three here. So this whole thing is a plus one, okay? And this was lead one. Now you look at another lead. Let's look at lead three, for example. And so these leads, it depends on which lead you're recording from. It's not anything abnormal. It just depends on which one you're recording. You might only have a Q and an R and maybe no S. Okay, so you only have a Q and an R. Let's say that Q is a minus one and your R is, again, maybe a plus three. Okay, so then you subtract those from each other and you have a plus two. So we have a plus one and plus two. So the way this is worked out, it's really quite neat. Now machines can do this very quickly, or you have an echocardiogram and it tells you this right away, or just an imaging now. But this is just shows you the power of what the EKG can really do. So you look at lead one, and because the negative sign's over here, and this is negative, 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 so all the negatives on this top part on the left side, you go through here, and let's say this is incremented out. So let's say this is one, two, three, something like that, okay? And we'll draw the same scale here, like one, two, three. If this was all on a grid paper, it'd be a lot easier, okay? If I put it on a graph paper, then you'd have the right units across here. So you take this plus one and you go on lead one and go plus one unit and you draw a perpendicular line. Okay, so that's a perpendicular line right there. And then you go to lead three and you go two units plus, because that's the addition here, one, two, and you draw a perpendicular line to that one. Okay, so 90 degrees. And where these two lines cross, right here, these two perpendicular lines, you draw an arrow, like a vector, from the origin to that spot. And that's the mean electrical axis. So it's a mean electrical axis of your heart. So it's kind of neat, because now you know that your heart is in this direction, your mean electrical axis. And that's the way your heart is in your body normally. What's kind of interesting is when people go to altitude, the heart mean electrical axis starts to shift. It has a rightward shift. And so why would it have a rightward shift if you went to altitude, do you think? Higher altitude has lower partial pressure of oxygen. That's the next chapter we're going to get into. And, you know, low oxygen, you're going to breathe faster, right? Breathe harder. And you start to exercise your heart, and actually the right ventricle will start to enlarge, and it starts to shift it over. If somebody had COPD, for example, fluid built up in the lungs, and what's going to happen? You got to try to pump, you know, harder on the right side to get that through the capillary beds, right? So what's going to happen to the right ventricle? It's going to start to thicken, right? So they'll start to get a shift, a rightward shift of the mean electrical axis. So just by looking at the EKG, you get an idea. What about a woman that's pregnant and the baby's pushing up? Sometimes it pushes the heart way to the left or maybe to the right. And you can actually see that, and they're having some heart problems or maybe feeling lightheaded. Sometimes it pushes the heart and actually kinks a little aorta a bit, and they're not getting the right blood flow. And you don't want that, because that's putting pressure on the aorta, right? And it's hitting it where it should be, a nice smooth flow. So the mean electrical axis, you can get so much information out of it. That's pretty neat about how the heart's functioning just by a non-invasive technique. So it's pretty neat to think about. On old tests, we had some quiz or exam questions on that kind of stuff in case you were looking at old exams. But we're not covering it on this exam this time, but who knows what might happen later. Or maybe that could be those extra 3 points somehow we might calculate mean electrical axis. What's some other neat aspects with EKGs? The P, Q, R, S maybe. Oh, and then you have the T wave, right? That's kind of neat. So what happens, sometimes you might hear of a ST STEMI, that this might be high, and it doesn't come back down. So this might be elevated, and this is a good indication that somebody had a heart attack. So this is really quite neat, too. They look at that very quickly. They might say an elevated ST segment, if you ever hear of that, maybe on a TV show or something like that, or if you're anybody in an EMS, rotate with EMS? No? Anybody do EMS work? It's a really good thing. There's some students that are actually got their EMS training, they're pre-med, and they actually work doing the EMS in the summers. It's a good job if you're interested in that. If you're allied health, you can really pick up some skills or just work. You actually can get a certificate or training in just reading EKGs for a hospital. You could be an EKG reader, and hospitals hire you to watch the EKG traces. They're all on a monitor, but you're just looking for ones that are beeping automatically. The computer can actually pick them up and say it's beeping. You know, something's wrong. Either the leads came off or there's something going on, like after surgery. And it will tell you the rate's too slow or too fast. Or maybe it's abnormal traces. Maybe they're having a heart attack. And so you check the thing and it tells you there's something wrong. So you look at it and then you read these. And sometimes then you read it and then you call the nurse or the doc right away and say, hey, there's something wrong with this lead. They go check on the patient, make sure the leads are on. So you could be a reader, an EKG reader. There are people hired just to do this. So that's kind of cool. And then some people actually look through these charts post, after a person's gone out of the hospital, and do meta-analysis, like did that drug work, or what was the problem in the hospital when these people had issues, and you read these EKGs and do analysis on them. So if you really like this kind of stuff, or you're interested in allied health, like part-time jobs, this is a really good kind of job. You can tell so much about it. Sometimes, what's really interesting is these T waves are spiked. And so that's a good indication of something that's going wrong, too. And this is usually has to do with a hyperkalemia, high potassium. And remember, is potassium critical? Extracellular potassium? If it goes too high, what happens? What happens to your body? You're going to go 6 feet under quickly. No. So the high potassium can depolarize tissue, right? You did that in your lab. You added high potassium, saw the depolarization. So think of your heart depolarizing. Think of your brain depolarizing. What's going to happen to you? A mess, right? So they can pick this up with a EKG tracing relatively quickly if you have spiked T waves. And so veterinarians also need to read EKG traces too. So the same thing. People look at this in veterinarian care, and it's really interesting if you're into veterinarian care. A great pre-med job too is a vet tech. Fantastic. You will learn more as a vet tech than you would shadowing for sure. Yeah, physicians. So really quite neat. There's even, I think I told you about a book by Robin Cook. First name's great, but anyways, I think I mentioned about that before. He was a clinician. He is a clinician. He graduated Harvard Med School, but he really likes writing, and he wrote really mystery novels. And one of them is on with the very timely, basically, but it's kind of an old book. He wrote this book, and it's usually about new things that are happening in medicine and care. Remember, everybody was very interested in DNA, kind of fingerprinting that body, right? Your body, your DNA tells you you're more susceptible to cancer or something, right? Right? Everybody kind of heard about these? Personalized medicine? Yes. And so you can go meet, what is that called? 2-3 me DNA? My DNA?
23andMe.
Yeah, 23andMe. Sorry, thank you. And actually, Jeremiah Smith, if he's in our department, one of his colleagues in grad school actually started that program, that whole company. So 23andMe, pretty neat. They took it offline there for a while because they were telling you that you might be susceptible to something, and then FDA stopped them from doing that, and then finally they were able to go back and actually give these charts. But you got a 23andMe DNA profile from either spit or saliva or a cheek swab, then they can list a whole these kind of cases, which they have such a good data bank that you might be more susceptible to one disorder than another, or you know, maybe something that you got to watch out for. And now people are bringing those reports to their physicians, and their physicians are like, what's this? You know, because they weren't keeping up with it all. But they're actually, it's forcing the physicians to actually keep up with this technology as well. And so it's kind of interesting. So everybody was getting these personalized kind of care, right? And you're getting your DNA sample. So what was happening with these insurance companies? Here's the story of this book. It's really quite interesting. Is that then the company, the health insurance, says, oh, you're more susceptible to cancer. You're going to give us a lot of cost, right? So the big fear of all this is that now your insurance, they might require you to get one of these, and they're going to see that you are going to cost them more, so they might raise your premiums. Now, that's a scary thought, right, that could happen. But maybe if you get a check and it looks like you're really healthy, they might give you lower premiums. So it might be good for the healthy people. It might not be so good. But why should you be punished for something genetically, right, that you inherited? So anyways, in this book, this is the story that's going on. So the insurance company was waiting for a patient to just get into a hospital. Maybe they broke their arm or they sprained their ankle. So they're in the hospital for something or selective surgery. So the insurance company was devilish. They hired these bad nurses that worked in the hospital, gave them extra money on the side, so when that patient's in the hospital, they would go ahead and do what on the IV? Inject potassium chloride into the IV. And that would give them a heart attack and they would die. So they would die in the hospital from some kind of trauma. And then the insurance company would pay off that person, that nurse, because, why? Now it saved them money, right? Because they knew that that was the case. So this is a story. But what happened? One of the patients had the EKG lead. I'm going to give away the book so you don't have to read the whole story. Okay? Save you time. So one of them had an EKG lead, and the doc noticed they have a high T wave. She was going into critical. You know, the EKG reader is saying there's something wrong with that EKG. It's going crazy. It's beating really fast. And all of a sudden, there's a spiked T wave. And they called the doc, and the doc says, yeah, there's spiked T-wave. It must be high potassium. Check the blood really quick, high potassium. So they bring the potassium down as fast as they could. Remember how they bring the potassium down, the kind of gross approach? You can put an IV in, flood it out, but also put something up your GI tract, pull out the potassium, poop it out. You do that repetitively, and then you can get that potassium back down. And then they realized, Well, if she didn't have that problem, they only had the problem when that nurse visited, why would the EKG go crazy all of a sudden? Then they tracked down that nurse and found a potassium chloride syringe. And then they coughed and busted the whole thing. That's the end of the story. That's your book. Saved you a couple hours of reading. But it's very exciting. But you think about that. Remember I did tell you, I think, before veterinarians used to knock down animals, put them to sleep by potassium chloride injections. And there's these cases all the time. I think in a nursing home, was it 3 or 4 years ago, up in the North Michigan or something like that, a healthcare worker knocked off a bunch of patients in a nursing home by injecting potassium chloride. So, interesting thing. You can see how important potassium is, but you can pick it up on an EKG. So really neat. Lots of interesting things on EKG. What happens if we had P wave, and then a QRS, P wave, and then a QRS, QRS, something like that. P. What does that tell you? P wave. Atrial depolarization, then a ventricular depolarization. So what probably happened? An arrhythmia, but AFib is really fast. But so maybe this is what causes the atrium contraction. And then the ventricle contraction. Maybe there's a separation of the SA node to the AV node, right? There's a block called a block. So let's say these P waves maybe are occurring at a right interval. Maybe these are at 70, if you did the thing, maybe these are 70 beats a minute, right? But the QRS is much longer, then that means they're not in synchrony, okay? So you can really tell a lot about the heart electrical flow as well by looking at these traces and getting ideas. So there's lots of different types of blocks. I don't want to go into all the different types, but some general ideas just to get you on the same page to understand what you can do with it. Non-invasive recording. It's so cool. Non-invasive, you can do so much with it. They first did this kind of EKG tracing in Germany for the ECG, or EKG, it's the same thing. Cardio in German, heart with a K, C for in English. But they had a dog hooked up and had the dog standing in, I think his name was Baxter or something. They had his name standing in buckets of seawater and the leads were in the seawater and they're just standing like that in the buckets. And they had this wires going into another room and they could pick up the dog's EKG trace. So that was some of the first EKG recordings were in a dog standing in saltwater buckets. Pretty cool that they could do that. When they created all this, then that diagram, that triangle is called an Ivanov triangle for the EKG traces, in case you hear that. But when they wanted to work out pressures in the atrium and the ventricles and understand the pressure waves that were going to go through, one of the guys in Germany was actually really quite interested about trying to figure out these pressure waves and how the heart was working. He actually catheterized himself and put a pressure transducer in his vein and fed it up, and he was recording the pressure waves, and it went into his right atrium and then into his right ventricle, and he was recording these, and he was so excited that these pressure waves differences of what they were, predicted, but they wanted human recordings, not from the dogs like they were doing all the time. And then he went down the hall, so he got in trouble by this. He went down the hall because his friend was working with x-rays, and with the catheter that he had in him, he asked to be x-rayed while he measured his pressure waves. And from those recordings, we now know, yes, that's the pressure wave in your atrium, that's the pressure wave in your ventricle, and he did it on himself. He got in trouble by the hospital, or the university he was at the time, because he did that kind of experiment on himself. But it was really informative to understand these pressure waves in a human recording. They had them in animals before. But pretty neat to think about the history of these things, right? The history is really exciting of physiology. Not to memorize all the dates, of course, that's boring. But anyways, it's pretty neat. And then we talked about the sounds a little bit before. So you hear, we're up there. Sounds of the heart. I'll try to find some neat little websites for these things. Maybe we'll get a quiz on it too. there's lots of different sounds, sound 1, 2, and 3, 4. We talked a little bit about those before, right? Love Dub. And we talked about Kentucky. And we talked about the Tennessee gallop, too, the fourth heart sound, which isn't that common. It's kind of rare. But there are these four heart sounds if you're into cardiac information. All right? But the Love Dub, you should know what Love Dub stands for, at least, right? So let's go through that again. Atria contract, right? And they happen together, right? It's not one side and then the other side. This is a misconception sometimes when I see answers. So the two atria contract, push blood into the ventricles, right? Ventricles contract. These are going to be higher pressure. What are they going to do? They're going to stop the blood from going back into the atrium. So what do? They close the AV valves. The one on the right side is called what? Tricuspid, and the one on the left side is called the bicuspid. Okay, peace. All right, so those close. That makes one sound. Boom, love. And then the ventricles are continually contracting, right? But the fluid's not going anywhere. Blood's not going anywhere, right? Because that valve's closed. The pulmonary artery's closed. The aorta's still closed. Ventricles are contracting, building up pressure. Finally, they exceed the pressure on the other side of the pulmonary valve on the pulmonary artery, and finally the left side will exceed the pressure in the aorta, so boom, those valves can finally open, push blood into the pulmonary artery, push blood into the aorta. What happens when the ventricles are done contracting? They're going to relax, right? So what happens? Backflow in the pulmonary artery and in the aorta, backflow. Boom, close the aortic valve, close the pulmonary valve, close those two semilunar valves, called semilunar valves, and that's the dub. So, lub, dub. Okay? Lub, dub. All right? Got it? We got it. Okay, so those are good. So now we kind of know the general sounds and what they relate to. If you're pre-allied health, MCAT questions, definitely know those kind of things. Okay, and then we've talked about the electrical flow, but the idea is that when you see these action potentials, another misconception is a lot of times sometimes on the Khan Academy, they have some misconceptions. Some students had come up with some of these misconceptions from that, and also on these MCAT study guidebooks. They always present this particular electrical trace for the ventricular muscle, right? And then what was this plateau due to? Remember we talked about that? So sodium in. You know, potassium maybe comes out. This is a muscle contracting. This is your heart muscle contracting. This is the electrode inside of the muscle. So this is an intracellular recording in the muscle, millivolts. So this is not an extracellular recording. So you have to kind of get your mind, you know, different from extracellular EKG recordings and intracellular recordings. So an intracellular recording, sodium in, something else opens up here, voltage-gated calcium channels. They stay open for a longer period of time. That's why this is at a long plateau. This is due to the calcium influx into the cardiac muscle. And then potassium channels are opening, right? They're open. So that kind of counteracts all this finally. And then it starts to come back down. Okay, so, but the electrical potentials vary, or the electrical signals vary across the heart. You get the pacemaker potential we talked about. Atrium is kind of like your ventricular intracellular recording. You see the fast rise, and you see this kind of plateauish type of region, but it's still coming down. It's not as long as in the ventricles. And then you go through the ventricle tissue, and then get down to the ventricle muscle, and then you have this nice action potential that's in the ventricular muscle in that broad plateau phase, which is due to the calcium influx. Okay, so you got that kind of in your mindset, a little bit different, intracellular recordings. This seemed to be a problem point over the years and confused with the EKG traces, but that intracellular recordings, okay? And the long plateau due to calcium, take-home messages. All right, so here's like just an example of the cow, but you can record EKGs in lots of different animals, and as I mentioned, they've got even EKG recordings now in whales and dolphins and all kinds of these animals. Okay, that's pretty cool. All right. So this is why veterinarians also have to check EKGs, not only, you know, ways that you can record responses. right. So just to remember these terms, systole is what? When the ventricles depolarize and they're contracted. So this is the period of contraction, emptying of ventricles. Diastole is the relaxation phase when they're filling up. So you probably measured your blood pressure, right? So systolic is the high, diastolic is the low. All right? And they're happening at the same time on left and right side. Okay. And I think we've gone through this. The main thing is, let's go through this picture right here. This is really the best picture of all. But I know this might be hard to see in the back. So let's go through this. So you can look at these diagrams below. This is of the left side. So pretty much this is happening on the right side too. All right, but a lower pressures on the right side compared to the left side. Now, some of your texts, depending which textbook you have, they might show the left and the right side. So let's just think of the left ventricle because it highlights all the points. The same occurs on the right side, but lower pressures. All right. So let's see what happens here. And we have an EKG trace here. So P wave is what? Atrial depolarization, right? So when the atrial is depolarized, what's happening? They're contracting. So what's happening to the pressure wave in the atrium? Well, let's look at it. That's this little green line right here. You see it's going up, as you would expect, right? Now, what's it doing? It's pushing blood into where? This is on the left side right now we're talking about. So the left atrium contracted. It's pushing blood into the left ventricle, right? So what's happening to the pressure in the left ventricle? It's building up. So you see that little red trace right here, that little red trace, that's the ventricle pressure. All right, so now, and what happens? The QRS complex is ventricular depolarization, right? So we have ventricular depolarization, so the ventricle's contracting. Boom, right? What happened right here? Lub, right? The valves have closed between the ventricle and the atrium because the ventricle's contracting. And what's happening right now in the ventricle? The pressure is going up. It has no place to go right now. The valve to the atrium is closed, but the aortic valve is not open yet, but the pressure is building up. So what's happening in this phase? This is isovolumetric contraction. Iso means the same, volume, so isovolumetric contraction. The volume's not changing, but pressure is building up, right? So isovolumetric contraction. What happened right here? It finally exceeded the pressure in the aorta. Here's the pressure wave in the aorta coming down. If it exceeds the pressure in the aortic valve, what's going to happen? It can open up the aortic valve, right? And now push blood into where? The aorta. So now the aortic pressure builds up. The ventricle is still contracting, pushing blood in. But as soon as the ventricle starts to relax, here's this T wave, right? Repolarization. The ventricle is relaxing. The pressure wave falls below the aortic pressure. Dub, right? Remember love dub. So now the aortic valve closes and the pressure wave in the ventricle drops. But what happens to the pressure in the aorta? Well, they got that little boost from all that blood being pushed in there. And then what's this little glitch right here? We see a little pressure wave that bounced, right? So sometimes, I don't know if they're still doing that, but that used to be on standardized MCAT and dental exams. That was called the dicrotic notch. The dicrotic notch. That is the pressure wave from the blood pushing on the aortic valve and closing it, but bouncing a little bit, right? Because the aortic valve closed. So if they had a pressure transducer right there, you know, feed it up the artery side, and you got right in front of the aortic valve, you would measure that little boom, right? Because that's the little bouncing of the pressure. And then the pressure drops in the aorta. And as we said before, that is main, you know, helps to because of that pressure wave drop from the aortic extending and then relaxing, helps to maintain that pressure wave. And then the whole thing repeats again. Okay, so we should know about these pressure waves, this whole diagram. The best way to study, not for this test, but maybe the next test or quizzes, is to do what? Take out a blank piece of paper and draw it from scratch, right? Because then you'll know it. And so that's really the best thing to do for knowing this. Just like the hormones in the menstrual cycle, for example, the best idea is to take a blank piece of paper and draw it out. So that was the left ventricular pressure wave. Here's the volume that is changing on the bottom of this trace. So what happened when the atrium contracted? It pushed blood into the ventricle. That's why the volume goes up. But during this high pressure right here, we see that the pressure didn't change, right? So that's that isovolumetric, just to drill that point again. And then as the blood goes into the aorta, the volume in the ventricle drops, right? And then what's happening right here, the ventricle aortic valve is closed, but blood will start to draw in from the atrium, because now the ventricle's pressure is lower than the atrial pressure, and blood can just kind of flow in past the atrium into the ventricle, and it starts to fill. That filling sound can be part of that fourth sound that we heard, right? We went through those sounds a while back, so you can actually hear sometimes the filling, and so that can cause a sound. And then the whole cycle repeats itself. So what do we see up here? We see 120, right? So you see 120 over what? Maybe this is 80 there. This guy's, you know, a little bit higher than 120 over 70, but it's 120 over 80. So if you were going to measure the aorta, the pressure in the pressure cuff, that you'd probably measure in the aorta, you know, you're going to measure maybe 120 over 80, right? So that's kind of interesting. So this is the pressure wave in your periphery artery. All right. So you could tell right away the pressure waves in the left side compared to the right side. The right side is going to be much lower pressures. But the same general trend, right? For the right atrium, right ventricle, same general trend, lower pressures. But most textbooks highlight the left side because of the high pressure waves, just to illustrate the points. Okay. Oh, I should have done this one. Sorry. That was bigger. Okay. But you get the thing. This is in your PowerPoints, in textbooks, online. You can do a Wikipedia page, all this kind of stuff. All right. And they have these heart sounds, just the lub dub, but they don't have, like what we talked about, the third or the fourth sounds, because they're not that common. Okay. So try to know, even a blank, if you haven't already got it down, trace the blood cell, like going through your systemic circulation, your whole body, you know, so it goes out the aorta, goes around, goes all throughout those tissue beds, goes through artery, arterioles, right? Arterioles, capillary beds, venules, vein, back to your right atrium, right? Right ventricle, pulmonary artery, pulmonary bed, pulmonary vein, highly oxygenated, pulmonary vein to your left atrium, left ventricle, repeat, right? Okay? So we should be able to have that down pat, like your name. Okay. Cardiac output, a really good measure to understand how your heart's working. And so if you got excited, what's going to happen? Your heart rate's going to go up, and you're going to pump more blood, you know, quickly. So your cardiac output would go up. But also, if you had a stronger contraction, maybe you're filling your heart more too. And so it depends how fast your rate is versus filling of the blood. But your stroke volume might go up as well. So heart rate times stroke volume equals cardiac output. So if we give you these terms on a later test or quiz, a heart rate and the volume that your heart is pumping out, you should be able to figure out cardiac output. Okay, so let's say heart rate 70 beats a minute, and maybe cardiac output is, I don't know, 20 mils or 40 mils, depends on what's happening, right? A young child versus older person. So then you could figure out cardiac output. So it's an index. Remember everything in biology. If we can put it in numbers, then we're getting there, right? Because then we can index things and see if the things are changing. So larger animals have slower heart rates generally, like, you know, big elephant, but they might have really big stroke volumes. So their cardiac output might be different. Okay? And as you get excited, right, heart rate goes up. In age, heart rate generally goes down. In infants, it's relatively high. Remember acetylcholine from the vagal nerve? What does it do? Slows the heart down, right? Muscarinic receptors, second messenger cascades, decreases the heart rate in the SA node, but also the AV node, so it slows down your heart. Some people get confused with acetylcholine with your skeletal muscles, right? It causes contraction. This slows it down. So it's the different receptors, remember, always the receptors. And then, like on that quiz that we gave, and I'm handing back those quizzes in before the exams and giving you time to look over the quizzes and the answers again before the exam so we can ask any questions that you have or anything that you missed. So we did that on Monday. We'll do that today. We'll do that again on Wednesday. So you look through that, make sure you got everything down on the quiz. But in those quizzes, on the open response questions, people kind of got confused with acetylcholine in the sympathetic nervous system, so we want to get that straight again. Remember, the sympathetic nervous system, we have direct innervation onto the heart, directly from the sympathetic nervous system, can increase chronotropic rate and also inotropic strength of the heart of contraction. The vagal nerve mostly is for chronotropic, slowing the heart down. You generally have vagal suppression all the time, sitting at a relaxed state, so if you cut the vagal nerve, your heart rate will go up because it's generally suppressing you. But you also have what else from the sympathetic? To the adrenal medulla, epinephrine, norepinephrine released in your bloodstream, and then onto the heart as well. So both neural and endocrine type of responses. Okay. Good. And you can imagine the pacemaker potential changes, right? Slows down or speeds up, depending on parasympathetic or sympathetic. All right. So we've covered that generally. Some terms, just, and you might, I think you might have gone through some of that in the lab. End-diastolic volume is the volume of how much volume is at end of distally, right before the contraction. So if you have an increase in end-diastolic volume, like if you can't pump well, right? Let's say you have COPD, mucus is building up in your lungs, building up in the bronchi and the little alveolar sacs, and then you get edema. That's fluid around that tissue, and then it kind of pushes down on the capillary beds. So what happens on the right side of the heart? It has to push against this closed capillary beds, so the heart is going to start to exercise on the right side, so your ventricle gets larger and larger. You saw those hearts in the outreach center, right? That was horrible. They can get thicker and thicker. It takes away, what? The space of the ventricle filling up with blood, so your end-diastolic volume decreases. So if you want another technical job or something in the summer, you know, the echocardiogram people, they're actually technicians, you get trained for that, and you can do the echocardiograms, right? There's a technical degree you can get, pay for part-time or something, school or summer employment or something. Then they can actually measure that in diastolic volume. It's so amazing they can get the size of that volume, and they can estimate then how much blood is in there. And they can estimate cardiac output as well from these echocardiograms. Really quite cool. How bad is the COPD, for example? How long have they had it? Is the heart remodeling? Right? So really quite neat. So that's an important part of the measurements. Now this Frank Starling law, this has been on standardized exams too. So if you start to build up volume in there, and initially it's kind of stretching the heart, it's going to stretch that right ventricle, right? When you stretch that muscle, there's a compensation. The heart will actually contract harder to try to get it out. And so this is called the Frank Starling principle. And so that might appear on standardized exams. So Frank Starling principle is to, when that heart is stretched more, it will contract harder. So if end-diastolic volume increases, you're probably going to have an increase in the Frank Starling principle until the pathology really gets so bad that it starts getting thicker and thicker and thicker, and it can't compensate by the Frank Starling anymore. So you kind of get compensation there for a bit, and then as the problems end up longer and longer, then that goes away. But generally, initially, and why is this important? This happens all the time with you, for example, right? And so I know this might sound weird, but this happens. This is sometimes where heart attacks happen. So let's say you're in the bathroom, and you're constipated. You had too much cheese, and you're constipated, right? So you're straining to take a poop, right? So what happens? You know, you're pushing, right? And this is partly to actually, this is a test to look at cardiac function. So this might be something that if you're shadowing, they might ask the patient to try to think about, try to say you're having a bowel movement and you're pushing. Hopefully that doesn't, something doesn't occur from it. But then, I know it's gross, but this happens. And so they're doing this, and they're pushing, like, you know, like you're having a bowel movement, you're constipated. So what's happening? You're pushing pressure where? In your thoracic cavity, right? and you're pushing down. So what's happening to blood flow that goes from your systemic circulation into your thoracic cavity, right? There's a diaphragm there, and that blood vessel, the venous return, has to go through there, right? And then what are you doing is if you're pushing pressure there, you're having higher pressure on the venous return, so it's not coming in. So you actually are reducing blood flow to your right side. And then you relieve it. And then you're like, you know, you relax, right? Then all of a sudden what happens? You get a lot of blood that will come in really quickly. And then you overfill a bit of the atrium and overfill the left ventricle. And then you have the Frank Starling principle. And then it's going to contract harder. So if somebody's recording that with an echocardiogram, they can say, oh, things are functioning right. If it doesn't work right, then you know it's not working, right? So it's a really simple type test. But what happens with people sometimes? You might hear of this. People pass out in bathroom stalls because they're constipated. And it happens in airports. It happens in all kinds of places. And that's one reason kind of the stall is up high enough. You can drag somebody from their feet and pull them out of the stall because they locked it inside. So you might hear of these things happening, but that really happens. And it's not that uncommon. I mean, it's more common than, you know, just walking around. So people pass out in bathrooms because of putting too much pressure. If you're constipated and you're putting too much pressure, they're doing it too long, right? And so what's happening to blood flow? It's decreasing, right? And so they end up passing out and hit their head or something like that, or having a heart attack. Okay, so kind of interesting to think about. Well, I mean, it's somewhat kind of gross, but it's practical, right? So it's interesting to think about. So do think about how the heart cardiac output is regulated. You know, it's multiple facets, right? Heart rate, stroke volume. What might vary stroke volume or end diastolic volume and parasympathetic versus sympathetic control, right? And all this related with venous return. Okay. We talked about coronary arteries, and you saw those in the outreach center, those blood vessels that go on to the heart. And if you have atherosclerosis, you can just imagine those things filling up. Big problem. Dilation with adenosine, right? So adenosine helps dilate those to get blood flowing to those. So pretty neat. And nitrous oxide as well. You might hear the little tablets that might put under the tongue to increase. So if somebody had a heart attack to go to the ED, emergency department, they might put these little tablets under their tongue. They only do it like three of these tablets. They find out if the heart attack kind of goes away, if it's dilating the coronary arteries. And then you feel more relieved. The elephant's not sitting on the chest anymore, right? And could dilate these coronary arteries. So they'll put one on, wait a few minutes or so, and do another one. And then they might do it only three times, because otherwise blood pressure might drop too much because it dilates. And then they can see if the heart attack is, or the pressure is relieved, it might be due to just a temporary blockage, right? And but this is a standard type of procedure. So it's kind of interesting to think about dilating those coronary arteries quickly and getting blood flow back to them with adenosine or nitrous oxide. Okay, so if we have to look at blood flow through pipes, so just think about it's general, it's not, you don't have to think about physics or math here, just think about a small blood vessel, big blood vessel, right? Big blood vessel, more flow through it, right? And but we want to look at the total amount of flow that can go through based on pressures. So if you had pressure differences from one side to the other, like 50 millimeters of pressure here and 10 here, you only have a change of 40. So that's how much pressure is across there. But if you worked on a like 90 to 10, then we have double the blood pressure, right? So now that's 80. Okay, so the pressure in this scenario is twice that of the scenario above. So flow is going to be what? So flow in vessel 2 is 2 times that of vessel 1, just based on the pressure waves, right? But you could have a higher pressure system, like 180 over 100, and what do we have the difference of? 80. So the pressure in 3 is the same as that as in 2, right, at lower pressures, because you're dealing with just a higher pressure system, but you also have higher pressure at the end of this circulatory system. So you don't want to be in a higher pressure system like hypertension. It's not aiding you because you have a higher pressure in your whole circulatory system. The pressure difference is the same. Okay, so that kind of helps. When we were thinking about, back to that scenario of the right ventricle filling up with blood, if you had like COPD, what happens? You're pushing pressure, trying to get it into the pulmonary artery, right? So that's called afterload. If afterload increases, you can't push the blood into it. So now let's think even on the left side. You have atherosclerosis. You can't get it, the plumbing's clogged up, right? So the left side has to work harder, right? So the afterload, trying to push that blood in there, have an increased afterload, that then pushes back onto the heart and causes the problems, right? Preload is pushing blood into the heart. So preload could be different, like we talked about with the constipation, called the Valsalva maneuver. That's what I was looking for. The Valsalva maneuver is like trying to poop, and you can't, like you're constipated, okay? And you can actually measure the changes in the heart rate as well as end-diastolic volume and the Frank-Starling principle, right? Because the heart rate will change as well. Kind of interesting, very practical. So afterload is what the heart has to push against. Preload is how much it's pushing into it. Okay, so preload, afterload. If you have a higher afterload, that's going to cause the heart to work harder, right? If you have preload, you could actually push more blood into it and then maybe have the Frank-Starling principle to kick in if it's stretching the ventricle and it's not pathological. So just some terms to try to keep, because those appear on standardized exams too. And not everybody's taken those standardized exams, but still, those are the main take-home points. Gravity, we talked about. You're standing up, right? So blood pressure, what does it do? It pulls in your legs, right? If you're not moving around, how to keep that moving around? Contract, right, your muscles. That helps push the blood around. We talked about the airplane situation. If you're in the, like this lady in the front row, she's in the military, ROTC, you might have to stand for a long time, or if you're standing at like a ceremony, a graduation ceremony, you're going to stay in the graduation maybe, and you stand still for a long time, you lock your knees, what happens, especially on a hot day? You just pass out, right? So what do? You know, you stand up and down on your toes, right, and move around. So you'll see people, and you've probably seen some TV shows where they pass out because they're standing still too long. So as long as you're moving your muscles up and down, you can just do that on your tippy toes, pretend you're still standing at attention, and then you won't pass out. Okay, so it's kind of neat. So those muscles and your skeletal muscles help move that blood flow around. Okay, pressure waves, like what we were just talking about, right? Isn't this cool to think about how long a giraffe's neck is? I always think this is so interesting. If they bent down, I mean, if you've been down, you have your head down towards the floor, and you're like having to eat food or something, right? You probably get lightheaded and pass out, right? And you think about, and then you raise up really quickly, right? And you have to maintain that blood pressure to your brain. So, but you think of a giraffe, my gosh, how long that neck is, and the pressure changes that brain is experiencing, right? To go down, has to make, you know, it's getting all that blood, and then it stands up, and all that blood comes down, it would pass out, right? And be eaten by the lion or something. So you think about, it has to maintain that relative, you know, very quickly. Pretty neat. And we talked about blood vessels, the veins having those little valves, right? You could do that. Has anybody tried that yet? Do it on your arm. It's really cool. You can find out where they all are. Like a dog's head, like a giraffe, they actually have these valves in their venous system to keep blood going one direction so it doesn't pool up on their head. But we don't have them because we're generally upright all the time. And we don't undergo these changes. So that's pretty cool to think about. All right. Resistance, we talked about resistance before. And this is important. I don't want you to memorize all this, these terms, you know, in this thing, but the take-home message. Think if you had a plumbing pipe, right, your blood vessel, and all of a sudden you had some rust built up on one side of it. What's going to happen to that nice laminar flow? It's going to hit that rust, let's say it's my thumb, and that pipe, and it's all going to be turbulent, right? And that turbulence is going to do what? Have little eddies going on. And what's going to happen to the red blood cells up on the other side of that little eddy? They're going to sit there and make a clot, right? And then that clot's going to break loose, and then you have a thrombus, right? So it's going to then go and block some capillary bed in your brain or in your lungs, and you're going to have pulmonary emboli, or you're going to have some, you know, brain emboli, and you're going to end up with some bad problems. So that's why the atherosclerosis is really bad situations. You don't have that laminar flow, for one thing. But that turbulence is actually something that you can measure. They can put a stethoscope and actually hear that turbulence, like on your carotid artery. That's why they might listen. It's not to listening to your heart. They're listening for that turbulent flow to see if you have any of these little brutes that they might call, right? And you can hear it. You know, it's not a nice flow. So you know there's a problem. And this is all due to this kind of term, which we don't have on this in this PowerPoint, but in case you ever hear of it, they actually measure this. It's called Reynolds number or Reynolds value. I'm not going to test you on it, but I just want to just say it. The Reynolds number or the Reynolds value is to measure this turbulent flow due to this problem in resistance or the turbulence, like for atherosclerosis. Okay. The take-home here is that resistance is related to the fourth, inversely related to the fourth order of the radius of the blood vessel. So it's the fourth order of this radius of the blood vessel, inversely related to it. So what does that mean? If we have, you know, these larger diameter blood vessels, then you can imagine how that's going to change resistance. But just logically think about it, right? The fire hose, the garden hose. But it's a fourth order relationship is just the take home from this. Of course, then the fire hose allows more flow through, less resistance than the garden hose, okay? But you might think about if the vessel is just two times larger, that means what? 1/16th difference or 16 times difference because of the fourth order relationship, okay? That's the take home of that. And I don't know if those appear on standardized exams anymore. There's some really old exams we had in 350 where they went kind of crazy with this and had you work it all out a long time, but I don't think I'd have those on the test bench because I'm not torturing you with that. Okay, so movement of blood, extending the legs. It's kind of neat in some invertebrates, the bivalves that allows them to burrow quickly. Ultrafiltration is really important in your kidneys, right, to filter the blood through and to even get urine formation for sexual relationships. That's important too. That's spongy tissue that can fill up with blood and for that. And also even this kind of little snout of this crazy animal called the echina. And you can see that this thing protrudes out when blood fills in there. And you've probably heard of spiders that can push blood into their legs and they can jump really quickly too. And that's blood pressure that's building up in these legs. Like the bivalve, they can push blood into there and help themselves to burrow down in the sand. So pretty neat about these pressure changes that can occur and depending on the animal that allows it to function in its environment. But, you know, don't go crazy with this. Just something cool about blood pressure and how it works for these different animals. Okay, so if we think about these different compartments, there's this interesting aspect about different animals with different compartments of blood and where they go. But the general idea is extracellular fluid is what? Fluid around the tissue, right? Between the cells. And then we talk about blood being a little bit different. We'll go through that in a minute. Okay, we talked about myogenic and things. We talked about neurogenic and myogenic hearts. We talked about insects before, tubular hearts, right? Like the Drosophila heart. And those little osti. And we've already talked about crayfish. They do have capillary beds, like in the lungs, for example, in the gills. Sorry, not lungs, gills. And then it might be an open circulatory system in the rest of the animal. So some invertebrates have capillaries. Some textbooks say all open circulatory system, no capillary beds, but that's a misconception, right? They do have capillary beds, like for perfusion of the gill chamber to get oxygenation and waste products out. Okay, so we can kind of skip through that. Generally, fishes have these two-chambered hearts, an atrium and a ventricle. Amphibians, three chambers. That was in your lab write-ups, right? You did the heart and the frog, right? And you had the atrium and the ventricle. And then, pretty neat, then you think about flow, like in an atrium and a ventricle in this animal. And then, like in a bullfrog, the two atrium, and then a ventricle with a not a complete septum, but still kind of changing the way the flow comes through. So the two atrium, what do the atrium do again? Reserve blood, kind of like a reservoir, right? Filling up. So why do we want to do that? So we have a lot of blood that we can push quickly into the ventricle before it contracts. If we didn't have an atrium, what's going to happen? Blood's just going to come into the, has to come into the ventricle, but it had to open up the valve so it could get in there, right? And we wouldn't be able to fill it as much. So the atrium is really important as a reservoir to then pump blood really quickly into the ventricle so you can get a higher pressure system, like priming the pump. So you see that in lower vertebrates, if you will, like for the, this animal, the bony fish, the atrium fills up with that blood and then pumps it into the ventricle so it can then go out. And then you see what's the next tissue bed it's going to go to? The gills. What? Why? Oxygenation, right? Get rid of CO2. Pick up the oxygen because you want to get the oxygen to go to the tissues. So that's very efficient. Goes to the gills and then to the tissues, right? And then back around again. What happens is in the amphibian, the bullfrog, you have the two atrium, and you have this general kind of separation. The evolution of the heart is amazing if you look throughout the different animals. Then you have the right side. Where's the right side going in us? The right side goes to the lungs, right? So here, let's look at the right atrium. Kind of, there's a separation a bit in this little septum that's in the ventricle, but it's not a complete separation. But where's majority of this blood going? To the skin, and then to the lungs of the frog. But remember, frogs are amphibians. They get a lot of their oxygenation, gas exchange, through their skin, their moist skin. So a lot of the gas exchange is through their moist skin. So it's like the lungs in a sense. But look at that blood flow from the right side. Skin for oxygenation and lungs. So pretty cool. And then it comes back around, and where is it coming back around to? The development of the left side, right? The left atrium. And where does the left atrium go into that common ventricle, but there's a little septum there. Most of that blood is then going back to the tissues. So you see it's gradually getting to the four-chambered heart to really then have that separation of pulmonary or gas exchange versus systemic circulation. So pretty cool. All right. That's pretty cool. There are these fish that are really quite interesting, and in some textbooks make a difference between the African lungfish and the Australian lungfish. I don't want you to worry about that. We've had people email if they had to know those kind of things. It was on old exams. Don't worry about the separation. The separation, just the general point. The general point is that these lungfish, they think it's convergent evolutionary process, is one happening in Australia and one in Africa, and these fish have developed different ways with their circulatory system independent of each other. But pretty neat. And there's some lots of stories of these African lungfish. So think about these African lungfish. They live in a pond of water. And in the dry season, what happens to the pond? It dries out, right? So when the water's there, they can get good gas exchange across their gills. But when the water goes away, what happens? There's no more, you know, good gas exchange across the gills. So what they develop this mucus layer around them, and they burrow down in, I'm doing the behavior, they burrow down into the mud, and they make this kind of like cocoon around them of mucus layer. It keeps them moist. So now the farmer says, oh, this is great timing to, you know, plant my seeds and stuff on this kind of moist ground that was fertile, right? Because the fish poop and all that kind of stuff that was living in the water before and all that bacteria and algae is down there, so it's nutrients. Right, so then they plow the ground up, and all of a sudden the fish start flopping out of the dry earth. My gosh, what's happening? Fish are coming out of the ground, right? So you can imagine the stories that came about from this, right? Fish coming out of the earth, right? And life being created by the fish, just like that. Okay, so a lot of folklore along this point. But now if you investigate it, you find out that they had that cocoon around them. And they can breathe through their lungs at this time because they have a lung as well as a gill system. So the take-home here is these African lungfish or Australian lungfish both have gills in lungs. It's really quite cool. So they can perfuse blood through their lungs or they can perfuse blood through their gills. And they can actually vary how they want to perfuse this. So that's the take-home with the lungfish. They're pretty neat. But again, then you see kind of the separation of the blood going through the respiratory tissues versus the systemic circulation. All right, so don't worry about the different type of lungfish. Reptiles, again, three-chambered heart, kind of like what we just talked about with the frogs. Crocodiles, we mentioned before, I think, about these animals being four-chambered heart. This is the first time that you get a four-chambered heart, and we of the animals in these lower animals. And I know what you're going to ask about, but don't ask right now.
I was going to ask about the lungfish.
Oh, okay. All right.
Is it the mucus layer that supplies it with oxygen, or is it just the lung? The mucus layer keeps it
moist. It keeps it moist, okay. So it can have good exchange, right?
Okay.
So, that thing, I know about this thing, we're going to have to address this later on.
Okay.
But then the four-chambered heart of the crocodiles, all right, is the four-chambered heart and the two atria and two ventricles, and they have these kind of really neat aspect, this foramen of Panizzi, or Panizzi. Anybody Italian? Want to pronounce that? Foramen means a hole, all right? So a hole, and let's look at this. This is really quite cool. So what they have, I think this next picture is better. Let's see, right here. So they actually have this shunt that they can shunt from the right atrium over to the left side and actually vary the blood flow from one side to the other. So let's think. What happens? Let's see. There's a good picture. There used to be a good picture here. That's not so good. This is better, maybe. All right, this is better. So this, you see the left side and the right side? They can actually have this bypassing the lungs so it doesn't have to go through the lungs, and it can actually change the blood flow. If they're diving an animal, like the crocodile, you don't want to perfuse your lungs, so you can actually bypass your lungs and get it out to the systemic circulation. Kind of like us as an infant. And we'll go through that in a little bit. So I don't want to go, you don't have to know all the details here. It's just that there is this foramen of Panizzi in crocodiles. They can shunt blood away from the systemic circulation or more towards the pulmonary circulation. Some of these arrows in your textbooks are a little confusing because it depends if they're diving or not diving. But the general idea is that they can shunt blood away from the lungs if they need to. All right, so we will go on to, I think, something really quite cool after we get past this. The idea of mammals and birds, complete four-chambered, no shunts, right? But be careful, during development, there's shunts that we're going to talk about. So as the adult, there's no shunts. So there's a complete separation of pulmonary and systemic circulation. Okay. And let's look at this fetus development, for example, in you or in other mammals. There's actually a hole between the left atrium and the right atrium, and there's a change in blood flow through the systemic circulation. So this foramen, another hole, it's called foramen ovale. There's actually a hole between your left and right atrium. When you're born, usually it closes because you take your first breath. Now there's not as much resistance for blood flow through your lungs, and it changes the dynamics, and that little flap closes. Have you ever heard of blue babies, right? That could be that they're not getting the oxygenation to their lungs. They turn blue. So they can go through and sometimes move the baby around, and maybe that little flap will close as soon as the tissue connects, then it seals up. But if it doesn't, they can go into surgery. They can put a catheter up through the venous side, get into the right atrium, and then push the little flap against the other tissue. But sometimes that little flap doesn't develop all fully. So even though they try to push, it doesn't close off. So then they can put a little patch in there and try to get that tissue to grow and close off. Or they put a little, like a sealant right there, a patch, basically. So that can close off. Other cases, you might have a ductus arteriosus. So let's just look at this ductus arteriosus for a second. Oh, right here. And why does this happen? We're going to step back, but we only got 2 minutes. As a fetus, you are actually very similar to the fish in this sense. You have what's called gill arches. This is us. Developing. We have gill arches. These gill arches are going out across your circulatory system. As you develop as a fetus, these gill arches close down and they become ligaments. So they're ligaments in you today. These gill arches, the ones that remain, like this one right here, makes the aorta. So it's the aorta. But what happens? You might hear of somebody with the aorta not off on the left side, but on the right side. And that's just because this gill arch closed and this one stayed open. And actually, the aorta comes off on the right side instead. So it's kind of interesting. But embryologically, this is what it looks like. Now, the gill arch of the ductus arteriosus, this one right here, you see this one? It's going from the pulmonary side to the aorta. So the pulmonary artery over to the aorta. What is it bypassing? It's bypassing the lungs. We don't need to perfuse the lungs as an infant, right? I mean, as a fetus, right? Because we're not getting oxygenation there. We're getting it from the placenta. We'll talk about that later. So it's actually patent. It just goes across. But what happens if you're born and that stays open? You have blue baby. So it's a problem again. So it should close after your first breath or so, and it should close down. The thing is that what causes that to close, it's related with prostaglandins. And we'll talk about that. So what happens if a mother is taking prostaglandin inhibitors because she's, you know, aches and joints with the baby? Then the baby's born, and you've been inhibiting the prostaglandins. So there's an issue, right? And there's something really cool about altitude. Baby's born in high altitude, keep a patent ductus arteriosus. So you go down to Machu Picchu, right, down in Peru, and it's kind of interesting, the natives that live up at the high altitude, their babies are born with this patent ductus arteriosus. When they go down to a lower level, they have a problem. But for some reason, they function okay at high altitude. So the government has a protocol to actually, for mothers that are going to have babies, bring them on down to lower altitudes, so the baby will have a closed ductus arteriosus, and then they go back up and they function fine. But it's kind of interesting related with altitude. I know I'm over. I went on divergence too much, but we will pick up and finish cardiovascular on Thursday. Need to get into respiratory. Respiratory is already posted on Canvas as well as on your webpage. And we will go back over some of this stuff. Gosh. Now, I know what you're going to ask, but we're going to save it, right? Yes. Because we don't want to give away too much.
Nope.
And we might have, we'll deal back with that problem. Okay. I know when I saw it, I thought, uh-oh.